As more people lose their jobs, we're likely to see more foreclosures. Foreclosures, of course, aren't good for homeowners. They're also not good for neighborhoods. And a lot of the time, they're not good for banks, either. Back in February, President Obama had a solution to get everyone to work together to stem foreclosures. Our Planet Money team has been tracking the program called Making Home Affordable. As Hannah Jaffe Walt reports, the team is hearing from a lot of people that the program is sort of messy.
President Obama had a plan. Jeff and Kira Nielsen, let's be honest, they weren't that interested. CNN was blabbing. They had a half, even a quarter ear to the TV. They were busy. But Mr. Obama kept talking, and it kept sounding important.
Through this plan, we will help between 7 and 9 million families restructure or refinance their mortgages so they can avoid foreclosure.
Jeff Nielsen thought 7 to 9 million? Okay, that's a lot of people. Then Mr. Obama said there would be a special plan for people with mortgages owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Jeff to his wife, hey, isn't our mortgage with Freddie Mac? Well, the TV responded, you've got to be paying more than 31% of your gross income toward your mortgage. Easy, Jeff thought. I just lost my lawyer job, he told the TV. Income? Those mortgage payments are coming out of my savings. By the time Mr. Obama was talking about resolve and the American dream, Jeff was already to the phone. Wells Fargo, his mortgage servicer, hello, I'd like to apply for a home loan modification.
And the bank didn't quite know what to do with that. We don't know yet. We don't know anything more than you know. Just send in, you know, all kinds of documents, and we'll get to it as soon as we get the details from corporate.
So Jeff basically guesses what a loan servicer might want from someone applying for this new program, sends a bunch of stuff in, 2 months pass. No info. He calls again. He starts calling twice a week. Another month passes. Jeff is told someone has his file on their desk, but no one can tell him who that person is, if they've reviewed it, touched it, even brushed by it.
Do you remember that scene in Kill Bill where Uma Thurman is trying to fight Lucy Liu? And she wants to fight Lucy Liu, but Lucy Liu has all these henchmen. And so she has to fight all the henchmen, and then Lucy Liu has like 50 more henchmen. And then you just can't get to Lucy Liu. But I feel like instead of being, you know, this really skilled samurai warrior, I'm like Jonathan Lipnicki trying to get through all of these, you know, henchmen. So, like, I have no chance to get to Lucy Liu.
I thought, okay, let's get Wells Fargo on the phone. I call the press person. He takes Jeff's info and then nothing. More calls, more email. We won't talk. And in the meantime, Jeff has got himself worked into a tizzy over this. You know, he's trapped in this customer service phone vortex. So we're talking, and I think let's three-way in Julia Gordon. She's with the Center for Responsible Lending. She knows a lot about this program. She can give some context.
It's extremely common. Servicers have been overwhelmed since this crisis started.
Hey, Julia, can I?
Yes.
My understanding is that they'd be incentivized to the tune of 50 cents on the dollar for every dollar they were able to reduce my mortgage by lowering the interest rate. I would think they would be greatly incentivized to want to keep a performing loan on their books.
That has been the mystery that's plagued us throughout this crisis.
Gordon says one theory is that the servicers just don't know how to do it. They don't have a process in place to change payment amounts and interest rates, so people aren't getting through the system to this shiny new program, a program that was supposed to modify 4 to 5 million mortgages. So far, according to the Treasury Department, servicers have modified a little less than 17,000. And that's the end, where the program is today, the end of Jeff's story. But then this happened. A couple days later, the story kept going. Jeff called Wells Fargo again.
And they told me something very different than they had been telling me for, you know, the last 10 days. They told me, now I'm approved.
You're approved.
Yeah, weirdly, as that sounds. In fact, when I hung up with that person, I immediately called back just to get someone else on the phone to make sure the person I was speaking to wasn't drunk. So I called immediately back and had the exact same conversation. He told me the same thing, so that was very heartening.
I called Wells Fargo again. What happened here? Still nothing. I called Julia Gordon. Ah, the being struck by lightning option, she told me. There does seem to be one quick and easy way to get approved for this program, Gordon said. Get national media interested in your story. That, or a member of Congress. Otherwise, you gotta join the line. Hannah Jaffe Walt, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. For hundreds of Chrysler dealerships, today is it. Chrysler says after today, it'll stop doing business with 789 dealers. Some of those dealerships made last-minute arguments in bankruptcy court to stay alive, but this afternoon the judge ruled Chrysler can go ahead and cut ties with a quarter of its dealerships. The company says it needs to do that to lower costs and emerge quickly from bankruptcy. We're going to hear now from one of the dealers who is accepting his fate. He will close tonight.
Ed Green is president of E.H. Green Motors Incorporated in Odom, Texas. For 73 years, the Green family has run the dealership near Corpus Christi. Ed Green's grandfather opened the business in 1936, the year Chrysler released the four-door Wingmaster and the Imperial Airflow C10 sedan. Last month, Ed Green received a United Parcel Service letter with the bad news. Chrysler was pulling the plug on his dealership, and Mr. Green joins us now from the dealership. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hi.
Now, you're in your office as we have this conversation, but walk me through the dealership. What's going on there right now, and what's the mood like?
Well, a lot of the employees, we have some that are just super loyal and faithful, and they're very mad about not being able to work for us. They enjoyed working for us. A couple of our mechanics have stuck by us till the very end, trying to get the work turned out, a few last-minute jobs done, because after today there will be no more warranty work that Chrysler will reimburse us for, and there will be no more sales that they'll reimburse us for if we sell something. So today's the day.
Now, I've never been to Odom, Texas, but I've been reading a little bit about your dealership, and it sounds like you were quite profitable. Do you have any idea why you were one of the 789 dealers that are on this closure list?
They never have actually released the criteria. There's been a lot of people blaming, well, it wasn't us, we didn't make the decision. So we really don't know. Some of the things that enter into the equation obviously would be the fact that we're an older established dealer and our facility has not been updated. We control a real fast-growing area in our state. The Department of Transportation laws say that dealers can't locate within so many miles of one another. We have the jurisdictional rights to that territory. Now, once our franchise is gone, then the manufacturer is allowed to move someone into the area of their own choosing. So we feel like that may have contributed probably more in our case than the fact that we were underperforming.
How many cars do you still have on the lot?
We're probably down to about 8 to 10 units right now at the most. We had well over 100 units when we got the letter in May.
Plan to stay in the car business?
I don't think so at this point in time, but I mean, I learned a long time ago, you never say never to anything. You've got to keep your eyes and ears open because you just don't know what might be available. But if I was going to have a choice right now, that probably wouldn't be the first choice.
I'm just curious, after all that you've been through, will you continue to drive a Chrysler product?
Well, yeah, I will for quite some time. You know, I'm not in a position that I want to just go out and spend a bunch of money on another vehicle. I have dependable transportation, so I'll probably drive that. And when I get ready to replace it, I honestly can't say what I'll do. I mean, my heart and my whole being is with a company that I've been with all my life. And no matter how upsetting all this is, I just don't know if I can drive something else when it gets right down to it. I've always believed in them. That's why I never took on another brand of products. We felt like they were the best, and that's what we knew, and that's what we wanted to focus on.
Well, Mr. Green, it sounds like a lot of people are trying to reach you there on the phone, so I'm going to let you go. All the best to you. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for calling.
We were talking to Ed Green about the closing of his Chrysler dealership. That's E.H. Green Motors in Odom, Texas. The dealership has been in his family for 73 years. It will close its doors for the final time this evening.
Now let's turn to one of the many sensitive points in this debate, one that Mara just mentioned. It's how to pay for expanded health care. One way would be to impose a tax on the health care benefits that workers already receive, although that's politically risky, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
For lawmakers looking for ways to fund health care reform, employee benefits are a juicy target. Taxing those benefits could raise as much as $150 billion a year. But that's not what excites healthcare economists, like Harvard's Catherine Baker. She says taxing benefits could also make the system work better.
This is one of the rare circumstances where you could actually raise money while improving efficiency.
To explain how, Baker cites an axiom of economic theory.
When you tax an activity, you get less of it. And when you subsidize an activity, you get more of it. we're subsidizing health insurance, so we're getting more and more and more health care consumed.
Leonard Berman of the Tax Policy Center in Washington agrees. He says because employees don't pay taxes on health benefits, they're effectively getting them at a discount. And as anyone who's ever walked out of Costco with more groceries than they planned on buying knows, a discount can skew one's decision-making.
Just like for anything else, you know, if you got 30% off on your next car purchase, you'd probably buy a bigger car.
And America has ended up with the Hummer of healthcare systems. Big, costly, and inefficient. The roots of the problem date back to World War II, when wages were capped by the government, and more employers started offering health insurance as a backdoor way to compensate employees. As far as economists are concerned, employee health insurance is still just another kind of paycheck. But MIT's John Gruber says the IRS treats them differently.
Suppose that MIT is deciding whether to give me a fancy new dental benefit that costs $1,000 versus give me a $1,000 raise. If they give me that $1,000 raise, I'm only going to take home $600. If they give me the fancy new dental benefit, I'll get the whole $1,000 worth. So even if I don't want it that much, I might still say, hey, that's better than wages because I won't get taxed.
As a result, Baker says, many workers who get insurance through their employer end up with more than they need, and much of the additional health care they use is wasted.
Some estimates suggest 30% of health care dollars are going to care that does very little to promote health. Meanwhile, uninsured people don't have access to care that would very much improve their health.
Economists also complain that the tax break on employees' health insurance disproportionately benefits wealthy workers who need it least, while workers who buy their own insurance, or do without, don't get a tax break at all. None of these academic arguments is very persuasive to Jerry Shea, who monitors health policy for the AFL-CIO. He says employees' health benefits have been hard won over the years, often at the cost of pay raises. And he's reluctant to see them become a tax target just because that's where the money is.
This is the Willie Sutton principle at work. And the justification comes from all of the ivory tower economists who say if you were to tax these benefits, it would make everybody more, quote, cost sensitive in healthcare and therefore help to hold down costs, for which I submit there is no factual evidence.
Shea worries just the threat of taxing benefits could torpedo the political chances for health care reform.
I think if you wanted to give the opponents of health reform a silver platter to campaign on, try taxing health benefits.
Supporters say any tax could be limited to affect only the most generous insurance policies, and perhaps only wealthier workers. Such a tax could still raise significant revenue to expand health care and could still make the system more efficient. In the coming weeks, though, as plans are debated on Capitol Hill, what's efficient is likely to take a back seat to what's politically doable. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Here's an old expression we heard from a young woman trying to find a good job in a bad economy. The expression is, man plans and God laughs. Today's 20-somethings are trying to start their lives during one of the worst recessions in decades. And as kids, they were told if they did everything right, they could have anything they wanted. Now, as young adults, they have to put that promise aside. Our guest correspondent, Judy Woodruff, has the first story in her series, Generation Next.
Sivia Finman moved to New York City with two college degrees, $2,000, and one plan. She wanted to do meaningful work. That was 6 months ago. She's still looking.
I'm not used to this whole key business. My whole childhood growing up, we didn't lock our doors.
She grew up in a quiet suburb in Michigan, the oldest of seven children in an Orthodox Jewish family. But she wanted to see more of the world. So she landed here, in the East Bronx, a musty apartment building where salsa music plays on a Saturday night. During the day, the voices of children from the school next door. This is Sivia's uncle's place. He grew up here, and now she's a guest, short-term, rent-free.
It's cute listening to the kids outside. There's always some kind of recess activity right outside the window. And I look out there and I'm thinking, should I have become a teacher? My parents are teachers. My grandparents were teachers.
But Sivia's degree is in public administration, a master's from Wayne State University. Someday she wants to make policy or run a government program.
I'm just looking through my inbox here and it's all junk.
She applies for any government job where she thinks she has a chance. She taps out her qualifications.
At the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Investigations.
Sivian knows she's competing with lawyers and accountants who've lost their jobs. She says she'd take any entry-level position. But with tight budgets and hiring freezes, there's not a lot out there.
The Patriot Act.
Sometimes she feels cheated by this economy. Government jobs were supposed to be safe.
Everyone was saying how there's just the government sector's opening up. This is things I've been hearing for years. And I just didn't think it would hit my sector as it had hit the financial sector. I didn't think it quite would have the reach that it did. In one sense, it was reassuring. I'm not in this alone, you know. This is bigger than me. This is bigger than the city of New York. This is a global problem.
But you still wanted to work in government.
You know, it's not as clear-cut to me today. Government was plan A back when I was finishing up school. I've kind of opened up the possibility to work anywhere. I just want work. I just want work.
And she does have work, just not the work she wants. With her money running out, Sivia took a part-time job as a cashier at a used bookstore.
Where are the cookbooks? Right in this section, like right here.
Okay, thank you.
She makes less per hour than a babysitter makes in New York with no benefits. But it's enough money to keep her in the city. To look for the job she'd rather have. Have you given yourself, Sivia, a kind of a deadline, or are you just, I mean, how are you thinking about that?
Well, the deadline would be really based on that number in the bank account. When I have just enough to buy that ticket back to my parents' house, that's when the search is over. And then I don't know what to do, figure it out, go back to my parents and figure something out from home.
Are you getting help from your family, or what are they able to do for you?
No, actually, I haven't asked anybody for money. There's a certain sense of pride with that. It's not something I'm comfortable doing. I feel like because I lived at home through college, they really overextended themselves. I mean, they don't feel this way. At least they haven't expressed that. But I feel that I'm turning 25 this year. It's about time I was independent. The one big concern is I'm not insured right now. I don't have medical insurance. Thankfully, I've been really healthy, but that's not what insurance is for.
These days, a lot of people in their 20s have the same problem. No job, no health insurance. But Sivia has a health condition that could threaten her life, Marfan syndrome. It weakens connective tissue in the body. Sivia takes pills to relieve stress on her heart. Without regular monitoring, her aortic valve could weaken or rupture.
I mean, I'm still taking my medication. It's generic, and I can pay out of pocket for that. That's not a problem. And I think I've been avoiding it because I find it distasteful, but I'm in the process of applying for Medicaid.
What's involved in that? I mean, how far along are you in that process?
I'm not sure. I mean, you always figure you'll find that job, and I think that's why I didn't apply for Medicaid earlier, because I was like, something's bound to come along. I'll have that work. But you cannot do what I'm doing. It's playing with fire, and that's scary. It's scary.
Your parents must be very worried about that.
I actually haven't really brought this up. I think we're just avoiding this topic. I mean, I've discussed it a couple times with my parents, but I'm avoiding this issue. I'm being irresponsible. I have to figure something out. And when I start thinking about things like health insurance, that's when all my positivity about finding a job kind of goes away. That's when I just become desperate and sad and scared. And, you know, all these emotions that you're trying to keep at bay kind of really pop up.
So how does she keep those feelings at bay? She tries to remind herself that many people have it worse, and that many times have been worse. She's talked with her grandparents about the Great Depression.
You know, my grandmother remembers going to the grocery store. Her mother sent her for 2 stalks of celery because they couldn't afford the whole bunch, and that was just part of life, you know? I mean, what I think we learned from that golden generation is sort of how to just survive without complaining, because they couldn't complain. And so I try to use that as an inspiration for me, because I feel like I kvetch a lot. I feel like I'm always complaining about this.
So when you have, decades from now, when you have your own grandchildren, do you have any idea how you're going to look back on this time?
You know, if I'm having grandkids, it means things worked out. And so the story will have had a happy ending. And I'll say, well, you know, perseverance really pays off, kids. And I'll be there for them in the way that my parents, grandparents, extended family, and friends have been there for me. It's a great opportunity to say things are going to be okay. And I'm fully confident things are going to be okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Sivia Finman has a few job interviews to look forward to in New York this month. But don't call me a New Yorker, she says. Not yet. Not until I'm paying New York taxes full time. For NPR News, I'm Judy Woodruff.
The series is called Generation Next, and Judy continues it tonight on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS and next week on Morning Edition. We have more information, which you can find at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.